Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, contractors working in Sun Prairie 2 years ago struck a gas line, ultimately causing a deadly explosion. We'll find out what, if anything, has changed in state regulations in response to the incident. Now, the coronavirus pandemic has changed just about everything about our daily lives, and for those who enjoy being in the water, that's no exception. For people cooped up at home who may have been looking forward to a summer of safely reopened public waters, pools, and water parks, it's all still up in the air. For many people, that means they've lost an activity that can be satisfying, healthy, and calming. Our next guest has spent a lot of time thinking and writing about the benefits of being in and around the water and why we humans like it so much. Bonnie Tsui is a contributor to the New York Times and California's Sunday Magazine. She lives, surfs, and swims in the Bay Area of California. Her book is called Why We Swim. Bonnie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, what is it about water and swimming that's so appealing to a species that evolved to, you know, run around on the land?
I think that there are so many there's so many wonderful reasons why the water is resonant for us. And one of my favorite writers, Florence Williams, a science writer, she describes it as the fact that we humans, are programmed to have respond to set points in the environment, which means green spaces and blue places especially. And so, you know, even though we have to be taught, we're weird in that way. We're amongst terrestrial mammals in that we don't have instinctive swimming ability from birth. We have to be taught and we have to learn it. And so I think in some ways, on some level, that is makes it all the more valuable and special to us.
Can you share, Bonnie, a little of your personal story about your connection to swimming?
Well, my parents have a meet cute, which is that they met in a swimming pool in Hong Kong. And so it's kind of my family's origin story. He was a lifeguard and she was a swimmer. And because of them, I have swum my entire life. I grew up in New York, Queens, and Long Island. And I learned to swim from a very young age. I was on the swim team. I became a lifeguard just like my dad and so did my brother. And we just had a lifelong relationship with the water. And, you know, over time, over the years, that role has evolved. I started to notice that after I had kids, that, you know, I swam through each of my pregnancies and right up until the day both my sons were born. Now they're 7 and 9 and they have just joined the swim team. And so, you know, it's just been amazing to watch them learn to swim and kind of ask myself what it means to me to be observing that in the stories we tell ourselves about swimming in water.
Talk about, I don't know, the swimming mind. It's really a unique thing. I've just gotten into swimming for real over the last year, and of course now I can't get to pools, but there is something different about swimming than anything else I've done, and I can't put words to it. You've put a lot of words to it. Can you tell us what's unique about our brains while we swim?
Well, you know, it's so much about how we respond to the sensory input of water, from the way it looks to the way it sounds to the way it feels. And our brains just change. You know, we have, you know, alpha waves that kind of are in response to the all of that sensory input and the calming effect. And we kind of lose the scatteredness, I think about when I go into the water, I'm kind of twitchy, you know, and then I ease myself and I start swimming, and about 5 or 10 minutes in, all of that is sort of washed away. And I kind of have a pacing to my thinking and to just my breathing. You know, it's all integrated into then, you know, how my mind is allowed to wander and kind of make connections that are different from when I'm on land.
We hear a lot about mindfulness, and I could see that happening while we swim. You know, we focus on our breath and our heart rate and things like that. But one of the people you talked to, I think it was a swimming coach, talks about cultivating mindlessness while swimming. What is that?
Right. Well, it's a practice of, you know, I think he's talking about really is a presentness. And we are so distracted by you know, different stimuli at all times, that we can't really focus. And so when he talks about mindlessness, it's that you've trained yourself to, you know, such a degree that your actions are automatic. So you don't think about the physical reality of moving yourself through the water. Obviously you are on some level, you're it's practiced. And so one part of your brain is taken up with that, but it's not the front, you know, at the front and center of your consciousness. And in that way, it's very relaxing. You know, you can kind of allow yourself, once you get to a certain point of your ability and facility with the water and be comfortable, that it just allows you to be free. And I think we all know that. I think we've all known that since we were kids.
We're talking to Bonnie Tsui about her book, Why We Swim. Bonnie, you share some stories of people who do things I would consider fairly extreme, swimming across the Bering Strait, for example. And some people have, I don't know, special physical adaptations that make them better in the water. Sometimes it's nature, sometimes it's nurture. Can you talk about some of what you found out by meeting some of these people?
Oh, sure. Well, the first and foremost in the opening of the book is an Icelandic fisherman named Gudlaugur Friðþórsson. Oh my gosh, yeah, he is just, there's a reason I opened the book with his story. So he, and you know, the story is that he fell overboard, his fishing vessel capsized one winter night in 1984, and everyone else died pretty quickly, 41 degree water. It was cold. You basically have 20 to 30 minutes max. And he ended up swimming for 6 hours to safety. And when he got out of the water, he had to, you know, he made his way to help and got to the hospital. And it turned out that he did not suffer from any signs of hypothermia, which is just impossible when you think about it for a normal person. And he was just a little bit dehydrated. And it turned out that he has this biological quirk that was just his fat layer was much more resembling of a seal's than a human's. And it's like 2 to 3 times human thickness. And he was able to keep his core warm and stable, and he just kept swimming. And he was a great swimmer. He, you know, trained in the Maritime Academy, and he those two things saved him.
That, and that's something that he didn't try to get, I guess, but you also write that some people have a different water superpower. They see really well underwater, and we can actually,
yes,
that can come from just early exposure and lots of swimming early on.
That's exactly right. I mean, it does sound a little bit crazy, but there are some sort of research studies that have shown with kids who, you know, grow up in sort of water environments, water cultures, where they grow up, you know, free diving for shellfish and all that, that they have this ability from a young age to focus on objects underwater very clearly, the way that most of us, we know, we go underwater, our corneas are just not, you know, suited to, it's very blurry. And,
right,
and then something changes with our focal, you know, our focal point, our focal fields, when you, the muscles in your eyes have been trained over time, and you can do that. You can train yourself to do it. They have found that, even when you haven't, grown up in those environments.
We're talking to Bonnie Tsui about her book, Why We Swim. And we want to hear from you. Have you had to give up your swimming practice lately? Are your kids missing going to the pool for the lessons, team practice, or just splashing around? Or have you found a safe way for everyone to get into the water? If not, what water-related plans are you hoping to enjoy once it feels safe enough? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with author and swimmer Bonnie Tsui, and we're talking about her book, Why We Swim. We want to hear from you. What do you remember about learning to swim? Do you prefer swimming in a pool, lake, river, ocean, bay? How do you feel when you're in the water, or boating on top of it, or fishing in it? Tell us what you love about being close to water. Tweet us at Central Time WPR and share your thoughts. We'll go to your calls. Carrie is going to start us off. Carrie is calling from Madison. Carrie, hello.
Hello. I love to swim, and I like to swim at night after everybody else has left the pool. The condos where I live have a couple of pools, and I'll be there in the evening and read until everybody leaves, and then I'll swim. And last year, my sister gave me some kind of a device with earplugs so I can swim to music. So I swim to Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and Amazing Grace, and I just love it. But I'm worried about this summer not being able to swim.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call. So Carrie likes that solitary swimming, Bonnie, and you talk about both solitary and kind of community swimming. Can you talk about the appeal, first of all, of just getting that water to yourself for a little while?
Yeah, you know, what I really found over the course of the book was that that solitariness, that solitude is really rare, increasingly rare these days, well, at least from a psychological standpoint. Right, right now we're isolating from each other, but we are still barraged with connectivity, right? We are, it's the way that we are communicating with each other, and it's actually, you know, more so now. And so sort of in more normal times, that to be able to slip into the water is to find some quiet. And so I think that that is so essential and so appealing. And when you start making it a daily practice, a regular practice, that it is, you realize that you need it and it's so beneficial to you. But of course, there's the community aspect too, with the teams and with your, you know, the people you see at the pool or in the open water where you tend to frequent. And that's really valuable too, because that's just your social, that, you know, it's your tribe. And I think all of us swimmers know that we have a tribe.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Chris now in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was a really good swimmer. My mother insisted that we take swimming lessons from the time we were like 4 or 5 years old. And I became a very good swimmer. And I went through my senior life-saving certificate. I took my final exam, which is swimming a mile, in Elkhart Lake in October on a windy day. It was awful. But what I wanted to say is that I can no longer do that because I have MS and fibromyalgia, and I can't be a great swimmer anymore. I just don't have the wherewithal. But if you are disabled in some way, getting into a warm pool and being able to just do your thing, whatever it is you can do, is really beneficial because it gets your cardio going a little bit and because you can't fall down, because I can't go running or walking because I'll fall down and you can't hurt yourself.
Chris, right. Thanks a lot for that call. And Bonnie, that reminds me of an anecdote you share. I think you actually closed the book with it. Somebody who had been a big swimmer, had a major health problem, but still found ways to get back into the water. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. And I just wanted to respond to our caller that the healing aspect of water, and especially warm water, well, and also cold water, but warm water, just how it feels and how buoying it is and how soothing it is and how much it removes, you know, the burden of a lot of physical ailments for a lot of people, that really cannot be discounted. It is so essential. I've actually gotten a lot of letters from people in this period that we have not been able to go swimming, that they, you know, they miss their daily tonic, you know, that's how they talk about it. And especially for people who are older, who for whatever reason, you know, for that land is just not the exercise for them, that the pool is the place where they're able to, you know, leave all that behind and be free. And in the book, actually, I talked to a bunch of researchers, especially longevity specialists, who say that swimming is just so great for example, arthritis sufferers, that just swimming itself actually helps their mobility and strength and pain management, even when they're out of the water. And so that is really amazing. And they've just gotten a bunch of published research on that in the last couple of years. It's pretty new. And so it's kind of affirming what we already have known for a long time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Chris. Back to your calls now. Jocelyn is with us in Sheboygan. Jocelyn, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about Jocelyn?
Well, I'm trying to condense all the things that I want to say so they don't take up too much time. But I'm not a great swimmer, but I'm a great floater. And I absolutely love being in the water. One of the things that I really like about swimming is the stretch that you can get, you know, along the front of your body that you can't really get any other way. You're just, the water supports you, and you can just get this amazing stretch from your toes to the top of your head. I love that. And I also I never thought I would swim in Lake Michigan, even though I lived in Sheboygan most of my life. A friend, you know, kind of dragged me in. You know, I was complaining about it, but once I got in there and started enjoying it, I couldn't believe how wonderful it was to just have that, you know, the waves, they just kind of like relax your whole body. And the last time I swam in Lake Michigan, it was getting towards the end of the season, and I was in there for like 2.5 hours, and I had to literally make myself get out.
Fantastic. Jocelyn, thanks for the call. Bonnie, what do you think?
I mean, I feel you. I am all about that. And I think that just the rhythm, you know, especially with an open body of water where you have wind, you have, you know, some waves and some feeling, some sense of connection to the larger world. I mean, I think when I am in the Pacific Ocean, I get out there in the morning and I just look and I think how lucky I am, and the sense of scale and the sense of perspective, everything does fall away in a way that is, like I said, just so, so wonderful and so rare these days.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Bonnie Tsui. Her new book is called Why We Swim. Back to your calls now. Ben is with us in Marshall. Ben, hi.
Yeah, I was not a good swimmer, but I was on the swim team. But I spent 12 years or more than that coaching diving and everything. I would wake up at 6 in the morning because I would have bathrooms, and I'd grab a bunch of raspberries from my garden and then run to the pool, like, be at work at 6 in less than a minute, and then spend the, like, coach diving team, keep swimming, like, whatever. It's like, this program is just fun. This is like bringing back so many old memories of my life as a swim coach and a diving coach. Thank you.
Ben, thanks for the call. Bonnie, I bet you've heard from a lot of people who just, you know, you were reminding them of their fond memories of swimming and diving and just time in the water.
It makes me so happy to hear these stories. And one of the reasons that I loved writing this book so much, and now after it's being published today, that I am so looking forward to and have been enjoying, is that everyone has a swimming story. No matter whether or not they call themselves a swimmer, they might say, I'm not that good a swimmer. And you'll see, as in this half an hour that we were just talking, that that there's something really singular and healing and wonderful and buoying about being in the water that I think we can all really look forward to on the other side of this.
We also heard from Rhoda in La Crosse. She wanted to ask about the link between swimming and the sensation in the womb. And you write a little bit about that, Bonnie, I know.
Well, it is such a funny, I mean, we can only surmise what we remember from being in the womb, but just the, you know, that you have, I mean, you hear your mother's voice when you're in the womb as a baby who's growing. And I think when you're in the water, in the pool, you know, you kind of, it's a muffling effect that you hear some people talking, maybe there's sort of like a whooshing, and there's something that I think people find very comforting about that. And I think that's why when they go walk to the ocean and people are so drawn to the beach and they're drawn to places where there is running water, they love waterfalls. Like, there is something about that sound quality that is immediately soothing. And once you come out of the womb, you know, anyone who has a small child will know that when they go, you know, rushing water sounds or, you know, ocean waves, they can use that on Spotify or actually go to a place where there is water that will soothe your baby. And I think that there's something very human about that response.
Hey, you know, you mentioned that. Can we do that for ourselves, not just our baby? Since we can't get in the water in a lot of cases right now, can we trick our brains into feeling like we're waterborne for a little bit?
You know, apparently so. I'm sure your readers, your listeners know about Wallace J. Nichols and Blue Mind. And so he's such an evangelist and an author of a book about that exact thing. And now he's been talking about, you know, even though you can't get into your pool or the water, the body that you love, it is still really valuable to look at water, to experience it virtually, he calls it domestic water. Waters, meaning, you know, in your home, like a bath or a shower or just looking at pictures or like watching something. I mean, you could watch Blue Planet, you know, it is something that is calming to us. And so even that kind of sensory input that is virtual is very useful and, you know, good for us at this time.
Bonnie, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Rob. I had a great time.
That's swimmer and author Bonnie Tsoi. We talked to her today about her most recent book, Why We Swim. You can keep the conversation going over on Twitter. What are your earliest memories of swimming? What's the most special experience you've had in or near the water? If you're missing swimming now, have you tried to replace it, like we were just talking about, with images of water or by at least getting near water? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. If you have a photo of your favorite place to swim, love to see that too. Also, on a related topic tomorrow, we're going to talk about working out at home and how people have adapted while the gyms were closed for quite a while there. Let us know what you did if you weren't able to go to the gym that you usually went to. Did you buy new equipment? Did you do classes online in one way or another? Did you take up running, whatever your personal at-home exercise was? Share your story and maybe we'll share it on the air tomorrow. Email us now at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Let us know if you added new wrinkles to your at-home workout over the last few months. Coming up after the news, it's been 2 years since a deadly explosion in Sun Prairie caused by contractors drilling into a gas line. We'll find out if any state regulations have changed since then and any other efforts to prevent that kind of accident happening again. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about a new community development initiative in the Fox Cities region to have group conversations on issues of race, racism, and anti-racism. First, Wisconsin has changed a few regulations since July 2018 when contractors struck a gas line while drilling, ultimately causing a deadly explosion in Sun Prairie. Parker Shore is a reporter who's worked for the Cap Times and has embedded with Wisconsin Watch. He recently talked to WPR host Keely Baltina.
It's been about 2 years since an explosion in Sun Prairie killed one person. Remind us what happened that day in July of 2018.
Right. So a company by the name of Bear Communications was hired by Verizon to install fiber internet under the streets of Sun Prairie. And on the morning of the explosion, Bear Communications actually assigned the job to a brand new subcontractor. It's common practice in the industry, especially in what's called directional drilling, which is what these companies were doing that day, to sort of subcontract out the work to other companies. So a company will hire a company, which will hire a company, and so on. And so they hired this company by the name of BC Tech because they wanted the job done sooner than the previous company would have done it by. And before you dig, you're required to call Digger's hotline, which coordinates with locating companies to spray paint where utilities are underground. But neither company did this on that morning. And as a result, VC Tech, as they were digging, struck an unmarked natural gas pipeline near an intersection. And the pipeline leaked gas for about an hour and then ignited into this massive explosion, which destroyed numerous buildings in the downtown area. It caused $20 million in damage and killed firefighter Captain Corey Barr.
And I understand he responded to that even though he was off duty.
Correct. Yeah. And there were other firefighters that suffered some serious injuries that day as well.
So the company drilling that day was not the original company, and it changed the morning of?
Right. So the plans were actually transferred in the parking lot of a quick trip because the Bear Communications wanted the job done sooner than the previous company would have gotten it done by. The previous company wanted new, more detailed plans to be drawn up because they thought the intersection had too many utilities to safely do the job with the plans that they had. And Bear Communications wanted the job done within a few days. So they hired this new company to get it done sooner.
That new company, VC Tech, did their work cause the explosion?
Yes, the driller for VC Tech struck the underground pipeline, which ultimately ignited and exploded.
And is that a crime?
The police ruled it not a crime. They sort of chalked it up to miscommunication between all these different companies. And Sun Prairie has since sort of instituted some rules to make sure that these companies are communicating. But no crime was committed, the police determined. There are some lawsuits sort of grinding their way through the courts still. And the companies were fined by the Public Service Commission, which regulates this industry, for $25,000 each. So Bear Communications and VC Tech were both fined. But VC Tech actually has not paid that fine, at least when we published this article in late April.
And they also, I understand, had not had employees attend an educational course they were supposed to.
Right. So they were required to attend an educational course, which costs about $100 on safe drilling, sort of teaching drillers, you know, what the state's laws are. And the company has yet to even do that. And in fact, they are back in Wisconsin doing the same work that they were doing in Sun Prairie, directional drilling to install fiber internet. They're back working in Wisconsin under a new company name. And the PSC, the Public Service Commission, said it's worried about this company working in Wisconsin, but admitted it had little ability to do anything about it.
Let's take a quick step back then. What is directional digging and how difficult is it?
It's a sort of relatively unknown industry. They do all their work underground, and it can be kind of innocuous, but it's basically a way to dig underground and install utilities that doesn't require you to dig a big trench. So basically the directional driller will extend this long, thin metal drill into the ground and then feed a utility through the drill. So you feed like a fiber internet cable through the center of the drill, and that's how they install a lot of the fiber internet and electric cable and other types of utilities nowadays. It happens a lot more underground, whereas in the past there's a lot more stringing it along above ground. So there's actually more and more directional drilling going on lately, and it is a complex thing to do. I talked with people that compared it to sort of operating a crane, which requires a lot of training to do. But directional drilling requires zero training in Wisconsin.
You can hire somebody and tell them how to do it, and legally they can.
Right, and I think that's a common way that it happens, that you learn on the job. You learn from the person that's teaching you, and maybe they don't have the best practices, because there aren't necessarily best practices being taught like you would if you're a crane operator, for instance, and you're a certified crane operator, which then you have to be recertified to do so. But there's none of those sort of training requirements or really much regulation of directional drilling at all.
Parker Shore has reported for Wisconsin Watch and the Cap Times. We're talking about regulations on drilling and utilities in our state. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Parker, what can Wisconsin do to enforce any penalties companies face if they've messed up?
So Wisconsin law, since 2018, they have sort of this new ability to fine companies that they find have violated laws. So the main one that would be violated is the law that requires you to call Digger's hotline. And since that law was instituted in 2018, they've only fined three companies a total of $31,000. And that's despite, through this reporting, finding that companies violate the state's excavation laws hundreds of times every year, it appears. That could be not calling Digger's hotline, which is common, and that's what happened in Sun Prairie. But it can also be digging too close to utilities with a power-operated machinery. When you get really close to a utility, you're by law required to start digging with hand tools like a shovel. And that causes hundreds of utility strikes every year. And yet, the vast majority of these companies are not fined or required to take an educational course. But the state law does have room that would allow for that.
Sun Prairie's incident was significant, but how big of an issue really is this? How often do crews hit utility lines when they're working on projects in Wisconsin?
So utility strikes are actually shockingly common. So there were nearly 4,000 utility lines that were struck in Wisconsin in 2018 alone, including 31 that were struck on the day of the Sun Prairie explosion alone. That being said, most of these they turn out to be harmless, but they can turn deadly as they were on that morning. So excavators triggered about five significant Wisconsin pipeline incidents over the past decade. And the Sun Prairie explosion was the first death caused by one of these strikes since 2006. But these strikes are common, and industry experts I talked to said cutting corners is a widespread issue in directional drilling. For instance, it's best practice to dig a sight hole to see where the utility is underground as you're directional drilling. But companies skip this step often to save time and money, and that results in a significant number of these utility strikes, data shows.
So who winds up paying for it when companies violate the regulations or misstep?
Often it would be an insurance company would pay for damages. But sometimes the costs are borne by the people that pay for the utility. For instance, the a municipally owned water utility, the people that pay for that water would end up paying it. So taxpayers would end up, basically residents would end up sort of bearing the cost of those damages in some cases.
And what are leaders in Wisconsin doing to make this work safer?
I have not seen a ton of stuff happening on that front of making it safer. I think the law that was instituted in 2018 sort of gives it room to have stronger regulation, but through the reporting, we found many instances where Wisconsin just does not stack up to other states in terms of taking safe drilling seriously. Even neighboring states like Illinois, Wisconsin is one of few states that doesn't require utility strikes to even be reported, so you can't have the super accurate information about who is even striking these utilities. And so there's just a lack of information and regulation on many fronts in Wisconsin.
Parker, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That was reporter Parker Shore talking to WPR host Keely Boltina. They talked about regulations for drilling in Wisconsin. About 2 years ago, a contractor in Sun Prairie failed to follow protocol and struck a natural gas line while drilling. That led to an explosion that killed one firefighter and hurt others. You can read the full Wisconsin Watch article on Wisconsin's regulations and learn how other places handle these restrictions. We have a link online at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we talk with a leader from a Fox Cities group who's organized a set of conversation guides to help people talk about race. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a play about poet Langston Hughes and his appearance between Senator Joe McCarthy's anti-communist committee is being performed virtually by American Players Theater. We'll talk to the actor who's portraying Hughes. First, what's an early memory you have about the concept of race? Or when did you first learn there was something even called race? Was it a positive or negative experience for you? Those are just a few questions from a free guide that helps people have community-building conversations about issues related to race. The guides were put together by the Imagine Fox Cities Community Development Project and their subgroup on the issue of belonging. The series of guides was launched last month on Juneteenth, the June 19th holiday celebrating the emancipation of slaves in the United States. Kimberly Barrett is co-chair of the Imagine Fox Cities Belonging Subcommittee. She's also vice president for diversity and inclusion and associate dean of the faculty at Lawrence University. Kimberly, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we dig into these guides themselves, can you tell us a little bit about this belonging effort that you're doing with Imagine Fox Cities?
Yes, Imagine Fox Cities is a regional visioning initiative that really hopes to increase the well-being of everybody in the Fox Cities region. And we had a convening, our first convening last fall, and one of the issues that rose to the top in all of our conversations, whether we were talking about the economy, education, healthcare, mental health, this issue of belonging and inclusion really was present in all of those conversations. And so we decided to make the focus of our first few years this issue of enhancing belonging in the Fox Cities. And so, we started this work up in spring before the COVID-19 pandemic, and then we continued it at a point where we thought, this issue of isolation has become even more critical, and so belonging is more important. And then we had the George Floyd murder, which ignited yet another crisis of conscience, I would call it, for our country around the issue of race.
I think we've found over the years that it's really easy to have a bad conversation about race in the United States. Can you talk about the goal of these guides to help people facilitate more productive conversations?
Right. People think that these conversations are really difficult, and they have been for us. But I think one of the reasons why they have been so hard is because we don't have the opportunity to practice the skills around having these conversations productively. So what we wanted to do was to serve as a catalyst for both having these conversations in the community more often, but also giving people practice and the tools so that they could do it in a way that was productive, that really focused on learning from each other rather than debating each other and criticizing. I think that at this point, we all understand, or most of us understand, that racism is a problem in our society. However, we don't really have the tools to dismantle it at this point. And so I think we all need to be able to work together to solve this problem. And the first, step to doing that is to be able to talk about it with each other. I think it was James Baldwin who said something along the lines of, everything that is faced can't be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And so this is an opportunity for us to dig deep and get real with each other about our understanding of racism and how to develop a practice of anti-racism.
Can you walk us through some of the tools that people will see if they download, say, the first one in the series, the ideas for community conversations on race? What kind of things is that going to help us do?
Well, for one thing, whenever you're going to have a conversation that is potentially, difficult, that potentially is controversial, you need to set some ground rules. And so we have taken the ground rules actually that was developed by a initiative called the Living Room Conversations and have taken their ground rules, which have been used all over the country on many different topics, and have, provided those for folks, not only with a list of the ground rules, but also an explanation so that people can, set the right tone and understand what their purpose is in having these conversations. The guide also provides, questions to get to know each other first. That's very important, to know each other as human beings first, and then have these difficult conversations and reflect on them. And finally, it provides some additional, resources. If people want to read a little more about the topic, want to understand the definition that's used in the discussion a bit more, it provides some additional, information for people as well. And then, of course, we want to have feedback about how these went. And, we ask people to provide that on the website.
We're talking to Kimberly Barrett, co-chair of the Imagine Fox Cities Belonging Subcommittee. She's also with Lawrence University. She's talking about a series of guides from the Imagine Fox Cities group, trying to help people have facilitated positive conversations about issues of race, racism, and anti-racism. I know this is still pretty new out there, Kimberly, but have you gotten that kind of feedback yet?
You know, I haven't had much feedback yet. I know that people are doing them or having the conversations. I'm going to need to reach out to a couple of folks and remind them to give us the feedback. But we just put out our second guide Monday. So we have three guides. We put out one, as you said, the press release went out on Juneteenth. And then that Monday, we shared the guide. We shared another guide this Monday, and we'll be sharing another one in 2 weeks. And so I'm looking forward to hearing what people are doing. We're also working with some organizations to plan larger groups that we can then sort of subdivide into committees, and they'll do it as an initiative of their organization. So so more to come on how it goes.
I want to talk a little bit more about the spirit of these conversation guides. The goal here, as I understand it, is we're not setting up a debate. We're not facilitating, healthy arguments. This is it's intended, right, as kind of a non-controversial, positive sharing and listening session. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I would say that it's non-confrontational and where people share their own experiences, because we're experts on our own experience, right? We don't have to read up about it. We don't have to, get a degree in it. And I think that that's really what is going to help us solve these problems of racism, is to really hear about and understand the experiences of others, whether it's people who have been, have experienced racism, who have been marginalized because of their race, or people who have privilege because of their race. And I think, the first guide starts with just understanding what race is. I think many of us are under the misconception that it's something biological and immutable, and it somehow determines people's abilities or morality, that kind of thing. And so I think just understanding, listening, and learning from each other is really the purpose of these.
Can you make a pitch to people listening to check these out and to take those steps to bring a group of people together to talk in this way?
Yes. Well, I think that, my assumption is that everybody wants to do the right thing, and that we're all trying to do what is good. We're all working towards the greater good. And so this is a way to take an opportunity that we don't often have in a society that is highly racialized, that there's a lot of problems and sensitivity around it. This is an opportunity to delve into it, learn about it, and come to understand it in a way that is relatively safe for all involved. And so I would really tell people to have this conversation at the dinner table. I mean, we've set it up so that you don't need to have any expertise. You can follow the guide and have a productive discussion. But if you aren't comfortable with leading the discussion yourself, we'll even have volunteers help you conduct a discussion. So it's a relatively easy way to have a very meaningful and sometimes difficult discussion.
Are you looking for volunteers like that in the Fox City area to volunteer, maybe get some advanced training and then help some people out here?
Definitely. However people want to get involved. Again, it's a tool that anybody, if they want to, can pick up and use. But if you don't feel comfortable with that, we do currently have a few volunteers, but we always need more volunteers. The Fox Cities is a big area.
Just very briefly, what is your hope for this as you get the third one online?
Well, I hope that people will understand how this illusion and myth of race has really impacted every part of our society, and also understand how they can help dismantle, undo, and really sort of make this a more inclusive, equitable, and fair society, which I think is what we all want. We all hold these values of equality, justice, and fairness in our hearts. I think our nation was founded on it, but we haven't lived up to it yet. And so I think that by better understanding these issues and talking about things that we can do every day in our lives to make a difference, we can really make a change.
I'm going
to
jump in. Kimberly Barrett, thanks for joining us. Find more at WPR.org/Central Time. You know how sometimes a catchy new song comes out of nowhere and spreads super fast and suddenly it's everywhere? Here's one of the latest tunes to go viral. Give it a listen. That's the latest release by a band known as Canadian White-Throated Sparrows. Sounds like a normal bird call, right? Except it's new and it's been spreading from a local hit to becoming a new standard. As reported in Gizmodo, the journal Current Biology published new research on the bird song. Research led at the University of Northern British Columbia has been tracking the spread of this new song with the help of a lot of citizen scientists who listen and report. They spotted a new innovation in the standard territorial song of the sparrow. They think it started as a local thing. They followed its spread then 1,900 miles over the last 20 years. Now, here's the difference in the songs. It's in the ending. Here's a listen. First, the old one, which I think is the one I actually played there. Then the new one. All right, let's listen to that one more time. So da 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 turns into da 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 da. Either way, it's got a little bit of swing to it. The lesson, researchers say this is a learned behavior spreading like culture from one bird to another. Maybe we need a dance remix from our own DJ Sarah Dactyl at the board there. It's bird news you can use. This is Central Time.